Get ready to rock radio, music you want to hear.
Taste toured in 69 in the States, opening for Blind Faith, and did the arenas. Now, what you had at that time, you didn't have a Polydor Records in America, so they would license, and in this case it was ATCO, which was the forerunner for the Atlantic Records. And the first Taste album and On the Boards, the second album, were both bulleting up the charts and keeping par with the Blind Faith album at that same time. I still have the Billboard charts there. But when the band got on tour, I don't think we saw anything of the people from Atlantic Records. It was more of a sort of the management, dare I say, being inadequate of, and obviously it was the first time and everybody's feeling their way, and 69 people, you were on all I could describe as a very chaotic supergroup tour with Blind Faith, who it was a band imploding itself. So, you know, Eric Clapton, who had wanted that the whole experience would be three bands, Delaney, Bonnie and Friends, who he later sort of got to be the Dominoes, or a lot of that band became the Dominoes. So he had three bands traveling on one Greyhound bus with no facilities other than a toilet at the back. Oh. You know, 52 guys and one woman on that bus. So there was no luxury, and that's the way Eric had, except Steve Winwood, decided that he wasn't going to be part of that, and he took off and went everywhere by plane separate. So, you know, it was very hard to get your bearings, and the band, the Blind Faith album, had been delayed because of the covers. So the gigs themselves were getting terrible mixed reviews. The band didn't have its own PA system. In fact, halfway through, there was only four of us on the crew for the entire production, which were, you know, you're in 20,000 seater stadiums. We demanded that they bring in a PA system. The guy came in, a guy called Hanley, brought in his PA system and said, "Well, I can do the tour for you guys, but there's one weekend I can't because I'm committed to doing an open air festival," which was a new thing, upstate New York, and that was Woodstock. So the band then got used to using a very good PA system and decided then to cancel the dates because the PA system had gone to Woodstock for that weekend. And I remember sitting in the bus with Eric Clapton asking for a show of hands to see who wanted to go up and do Woodstock and take the chances of being paid or not paid, or despite what the weather forecast was, and all the guys from Delaney and Bonnie voting him down. It was that kind of a chaotic kind of tour, but that you just rolled with it, you know.
Yes. Are you saying then really that didn't help Taste and Rory in terms of, you know, technical difficulties and the politics and what have you?
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, it was getting exposure, you know, to audiences, but when you're an opening act and, you know, the Blind Faith record was also on ATCO, so they would obviously deservedly so get the lion's share of the attention. But things weren't planned, dates were being cancelled, the schedule kept moving around. So, you know, it was a learning curve for the band. Rory was disappointed with his management at that time that they hadn't got him gigs on in his own right, because, it had gone Billboard Top 100 with the first two albums. So, you know, he felt that he could get some attention. By the end of the tour, we did get a couple of club gigs in Los Angeles and places like that, and they were well attended. But the band was already sort of booked out in Europe, so they couldn't carry on promoting the album, and which is the way Rory wanted it to go. But that said, Rory had a ball in the sense of the number of musicians who would come on and off that tour. I mean, you had J.J. Cale, Leon Russell, Dave Mason, you know, Bobby Keys, Jim Keltner. I mean, the whole Delaney and Bonnie experience gave them a network of musician friends for life, you know, learned a great deal. You know.
Since the 90s, you've kept the name in the forefront of people's minds, haven't you, you know?
Well, it's a labour of love.
Yes, and there's probably always something, isn't there, on a year-by-year basis where if it's not an anniversary, there'll be something else to celebrate.
Well, I mean, he put so much out himself, you know what I mean, and obviously when you know, there was just two of us as siblings, so you grew up together, so there's a huge shared experience, and then, you know, there's obviously a terrible loss, but, you know, the fact that there's so much, it's so well archived and recorded that it's quite amazing, you know, the presence you have, the person's still there to a certain extent, you know. And, you know, that's where I feel really sorry for people who don't have, you know, some important, they don't even have sort of pictures or footage of family members or whatever, because it's the same thing, you know.
And I'm right in saying you were really the right-hand man, weren't you, for most of his career?
Yeah, I mean, but effectively, yeah. From starting with him originally, because the family kind of travelled a lot, your childhood is shared because you're strangers in different towns, and you kind of bond probably closer than most. And then, you know, he was the bigger brother, but Roy was so like an extra set. He was locked into what he was going to do. You know, whereas I was still deciding between the fireman, the policeman, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker. Roy was already the musician at sort of 5-6 years of age. You know, I mean, the alternative was probably a cowboy, but he knew what he wanted. You know, so you admire that, and you kind of, when you're a little confused yourself, so you kind of you stick with what that person is doing, and. You know, and you always look up to your elder sibling anyway. And
Rory, as a person, I mean, I get the impression, you must get asked this so many times, Donald, really. I mean, I get the impression as a listener and someone who's watched the films and you read books and everything, he was a very gentle guy, very focused, very likeable.
Yes, he was. I mean, it was two characters almost. On stage, Rory was... It was a different character off stage. He was a very modest, decent person, and you know, was a fan of music himself. And so he saw his own fans very much the way he would sort of respect the Stones or the bands he loved. And he was like nobody. He wasn't a saint, but to me, he was saint-like almost, because the guy didn't swear, he didn't smoke cigarettes, he didn't, you know. And this was the conundrum that, in the end, that his demise came about. That he was such an intelligent guy that it sort of took us all kind of by surprise in that respect. And he was a very dignified person, and. He, a pacifist. He hated trouble. I mean, I was always, you know, getting myself in trouble, and you'd always feel that big arm on your shoulder of putting you back in your box and telling you, you know, you can't treat people like that, or, you know, I was being chastised, I felt, all the time. But he was a super person.
Now, what's in store for us? Have you got anything scheduled for the coming months in terms of, is there anything more to release?
There's quite a bit of live stuff, because fortunately a lot of stuff is recorded. I mean, there's all the legacy at the BBC. I mean, there's no definite plan, but I mean, I'm working on a couple of, dare I say, top secret projects. So, which in time will I think surprise people. I'm also having to. Get the definitive Rory book written, and but Rory's music comes first, so I get so far, and then there's a release of some kind or another, or a DVD that you have to get involved with, so you kind of think that, you know, I put my more priority on new stuff. But also there's a film underway, or the wheels in motion in America to make the proverbial motion picture about Rory. Not a biopic, because when I was approached about that, I said I just wouldn't see it. He was too live and still too. But it's what the intrigue is, the life and times which we've largely spoken of you know, particularly Ireland and its culture and the troubles, etc., how somebody growing up through that period. Because, in fact, the movie The Commitments, the inspiration for the character in that was drawn from Rory, the guy who's, you know, saying dance music wasn't where I was at. It was, you know, to get into the soul, the black soul singer. So that was, in effect, it was kind of, you know, Rory was the kind of character who was inspired that whole movie, and in fact was offered the part because they were curious to see the guy in full circle. So Rory wanted to play the part of Joey the Lips, and I remember Rory refusing to do it, and there was anyway, he eventually agreed to go and talk to the film people about it and read for them, you know. But so he went along, and the day I went with him, and at that time, to be quite honest, I thought, this is manna from heaven, this will be a change of direction, which at that time I felt would be good for Rory to you know, get off the road for a while, maybe do something different, clear his head. And he I remember he just sent the director Van Morrison's mobile number and said, you know, if you're looking for a guy who plays a brass instrument, and why don't you give Van a call? And just walked out in it. As you say, wonderful memories.
This is radio for the internet age. Get ready to rock radio.
Now, we should mention also that last year reissued on DVD and Blu-ray the excellent Tony Palmer film. In which you appeared, Donald. It's a really honest account, I think, of a touring musician in the first part of the 70s. Do you have any particular special memories from that tour, that period, really, the early 70s?
Yeah, I have lots of memories of it, because it was such a burden to be told that there was, on top of everything else, to go into Ireland, given the troubles in the north. Not that you were responsible, but you felt responsible for a film crew on top of everything else. And it was complicating matters then, because also Rory was recording it for an album, so there was going to be a mobile unit. And plus, it wasn't as if the promoters allowed the space in the hall for cameras or for mixing desks and all the luxuries that you see nowadays. And I mean, what's very clear is how spartan it was backstage. And, you know, there was one box of beer or whatever. Also, you're talking about venues like Ulster Hall. Now, parallel in another world was, that was Ian Paisley's church at that time. And so he had it so many nights a week. So he had control of the backstage, it was a municipal hall, so he had got the keys to all the main decent dressing rooms where he kept his vestments or whatever. So you weren't allowed into those rooms. So it was very restrictive. So, then getting the crew, then the mobile unit didn't turn up. So, you know, and all I wanted to do was see the band got on the stage, get as good a sound as possible, and let it rock. You know, so, you know, and then you were all these other technical guys asking questions, and then we had no mobile unit in Belfast because they couldn't get insurance, and so then I was having to modify the mixing desk, which I had just had built in Hamburg, and luckily there were a couple of fallback lines that were spare, so I was able to do a separate mix then for the little film tape machines, the Nagras, so that that's how we got the audio. The mobile unit only turned up for one night on the very last night in Cork. It finally arrived, but so that, you know, and plus Rory's stature in Ireland. I mean, there's, to be honest, there's almost a film to be made about what isn't in the film as well. I mean, there was a fantastic session, and, you know, the Dubliners turned up at the hotel after the gig in Dublin. So they had done their gig, and they had a few pints in them, and we were known to take a few pints. So there was a music session that happened in the foyer of the hotel. Went down to, I remember being stopped from climbing down the side of the Liffey River with Barney McCann, or the banjo player, who was taking me off fishing for the day, and somebody telling me, you know, there's a gig in Cork tonight. And having to have a good breakfast and straighten up and get down to Cork, and you know, not least then in Cork itself, the, you know, and what you see of that after tour party was done in a bar and a rowing club, and there was quite a mayhem. But I think I'd be sued if I explained.
We only get the editor's highlights.
This involved a cop car being put into the Lee River in Cork, and you know, having to use a car to take people to the infirmary that night, and spending the night in the infirmary with hoping people would survive. It was double trouble, put it that way.
All in a tour manager's day, Donald.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, of the film material that's come out since Rory's death, I mean, is there any one particular DVD, Blu-ray disc that you'd point people towards? I mean, I've mentioned the Tony Palmer film, but there are other, I mean, there's like the Rock Palace footage, isn't there?
Yeah, well, Rory always gave 100%, so, and fortunately in Europe, he was so highly regarded that they allowed him the freedom to do the Rock Palace, where they wouldn't interrupt his set or anything, and he played straight off as he wanted. So it's well captured there. I mean, Montreux is another example. I mean, in fairness, Eagle Rock are a great company in the music DVD world. And also then there's the more recent documentary that was done by Ian Tullier, which was screened on Sky Arts the other evening, in fact, called Ghost Blues. And I'd point people to that, because it gives you a little bit of Montreux. It gives you, you know, as, dare I say, as the word sampler, you know, it gives the broader thing from, you know, Irish Tour in one sense is unique, and it is very much, as you said, you know, the touring band at that time period, you know.
Yeah.
It's warts and all, you know. I suppose Ghost Blues is the full life. It's you know, the beginning to end.
Yeah, more rounded picture, really.
Yeah.